Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Democrats in New York are moving ahead with new laws to protect immigrants, despite a threat from the Trump administration to surge federal agents. The New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
State lawmakers are taking up a bill to ban formal agreements with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and prohibit local jail cells from being used for immigration detention. Republicans say the bill will make it harder to fight crime. Federal Border Czar Tom Homan threatened to surge ICE agents into New York if the bill becomes law. State Senator Andrew Gunardis is a Brooklyn Democrat. He supports the bill and shrugged off Homan's threat.
We have a responsibility to protect our constituents, to protect our neighbors, and to stand for values that we all believe in, and that's what we're going to do. So frankly, Tom Homan can go shove it.
Governor Hochul says she'll sign the measure. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with David Albert, Chief Communications and Marketing Officer for the New York State School Boards Association, and we began by talking about how, once again, the majority of school districts around the state passed their school budget proposals this week.
This year was very consistent with previous years, and that is the vast majority, and I think this year it was 98% of school budgets that just needed a simple majority because they were within their tax cap, 98% of those budgets passed, which is pretty consistent with previous years. It's typically around 98, 99% passage rate if your budget is in within the tax cap. If you're attempting a tax cap override, you know, a much lower number of districts attempt that. But it is hard to do. You need to get 60% of the voters to approve the budget. And we often see districts get 58, 59%. It's just not enough to get them across to that 60% threshold. So those budgets tend to have about a 66% passage rate. So obviously it's much lower. If you combine all of the districts, the districts that simply needed a simple majority for passage and the override districts, it comes together to be about a 96% passage rate.
That's quite impressive, really, if you think about it. But at the same time, Assembly Ways and Means Committee Chairman Gary Pretlow, which I think is interesting, he said even though the class sizes are shrinking, the fixed costs aren't. School buildings are still there. And of course, the costs, David Albert from the New York State School Boards Association, are only going up. And we're seeing that increasing dynamically with the cost of fuel. And that impacts all sorts of other things as well.
Right. And that's a great point that schools really do face a lot of fixed costs. And sometimes people will talk about declining enrollment, which we do see here in many, many schools in New York State, and say, if there's less enrollment, then shouldn't the school be able to cut, you know, some of its budget? And it's not as easy as that because you don't necessarily have that ability to eliminate a whole class or close a school building. You know, oftentimes you may lose students in certain grades, but you still have to have a third grade. You know, you still have to have a fourth grade. I mean, right. It's more challenging than it may appear at first. But to your point about increased expenditures, this is true for schools. You know, all of us, I think, in our everyday lives are facing higher costs for fuel, higher costs to heat and cool our homes, higher costs for groceries. And we're seeing that in schools. Schools do the same things. They have food service programs to provide lunch for students. Those costs go up. they have diesel buses and electric buses, mostly diesel at this point, but they have to buy fuel, and so those costs are going up. They have to heat and cool the school buildings. So there's a lot of costs that increase, and also you have things such as health insurance, which is very expensive, and we've seen double-digit percentage increases in health insurance.
Oh, yeah.
And that has also increased costs for school districts. Schools have contractual obligations that they have to meet every year, whether it be, you know, salaries for employees or contracts with bus providers, whatever the case may be. So just as we all experience in our day-to-day lives increased costs, schools certainly experience that as well. So they have to be able to meet those costs. At the same time, it makes sure that they're providing a good, sound, quality education at a cost that taxpayers can afford.
Yeah, and you know, as the class size shrinks, it's also not as easy as people would like to think for schools to merge or consolidate, right? I mean, there's often pushback when that happens, and that's not just here in New York, that's all over the country.
That's absolutely true, and certainly some people may suggest looking at mergers, and schools do that. There are a couple of discussions underway right now across the state for potential school district mergers. And those are complicated. And ultimately, what we find is that most proposed mergers fail. And the reason they fail is because the community votes them down. The community doesn't want the merger. And if you think about your local school district and you think about the sense of, you know, community that we all feel around local schools, sense of identity, sense of pride. And also, you also have to take a look at educational programs and services and what would happen if districts merge. Would there be greater opportunities for students? So there's a lot of factors. Transportation is another one. Parents don't want their students on riding on buses for an hour to get to school and back. So there's a lot of things that need to be worked out in a merger. And typically what we find is if the merger can really offer enhanced educational opportunities for students, that is really the key driver as to whether a merger is successful or not.
That's David Albert, Chief Communications and Marketing Officer for the New York State School Boards Association. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Although, as we just discussed, over 95% of New York school districts approved their school budgets this week, a handful did not. One of those was New Lebanon. And now, for the second year in a row, parents and teachers in the Columbia County town of about 2,500 are facing uncertainty. The Legislative Gazette's Sam Dingman takes a closer look.
Blaine Darcy was feeling optimistic going into Tuesday's vote, but she knew there was a potential sticking point, the tax levy. By law, districts are allowed to assess a levy, basically an increase on top of local taxes people are already paying, to fund school budgets. The state limits the size of the levy each district can impose. It's a complex formula that varies by location. New Lebanon's limit was 4.3%, and for this budget, they were asking for 6%. Still, Blaine and others were hopeful the budget would still pass. Last year's budget had passed with a 9% levy. Blaine has two daughters, one of whom attends the local elementary school, Walter B. Howard. She's also president of the PTA. So she's very invested in the future of the New Lebanon schools, especially because she's lived through what she calls the missteps of the recent past.
For about 10 years, there was no increase in taxes. Now we're really paying the price.
Blaine says schools need money to cover costs that should have been anticipated during that long period with no tax levies. The previous budget, the one with the 9% levy, actually failed on the first vote. The board initially asked for 15%, and voters rejected it. So they revised the levy and eliminated a bunch of staff, including a reading teacher and a psychologist, and it passed on a follow-up vote. But this year, when the results came in Tuesday, the budget didn't pass, even though a majority of voters supported it. 58.8% of them voted yes, but because the levy was above the legal cap, they needed a supermajority, 60%. And that 1.2% miss, according to another PTA member named Eileen Robb, was heartbreaking.
In New Lebanon, that's 7 votes.
The board now has just under a month to revise the budget and bring it back to voters. But like last year, when those jobs were eliminated to get the budget passed, the stakes are high.
I think what is realistically on the chopping block first this year is all of the extras, quote, like music, art, athletics, new equipment. Those things will be the first to see a hit.
In addition to being the PTA president, Blaine also runs a business in New Lebanon, and she says there was a new wrinkle when it came to this year's budget debate, the war in Iran and the inflation and price increases that have come along with it. People are feeling even more stressed out about money than normal.
They have no control over the rising gas price, the rising energy costs, the rising food costs, but they do have the ability to say no to their school tax increasing, so they exercise that.
A lot of what happened in New Lebanon, it seems, does boil down to this sort of psychological issue when it comes to taxes. For instance, in Hudson, where voters did approve the school budget on Tuesday, the proposed tax levy was 5.8%, not so different from the 6% that New Lebanon voters rejected. But there's a key difference. In Hudson, that 5.8% was at the legal limit for tax hikes, that number the state calculates for each region. In New Lebanon, the 6% was slightly over the state-imposed limit. Both districts were asking voters to pay more taxes, but in New Lebanon, the idea that the levy was, quote, above the cap seems to have turned people off.
I think just that verbiage really seems to get people rabble-rousing because I guess it kind of drives the idea that the school is just grasping for too much. They're being greedy.
Just to reiterate, a strong majority of voters, 58.8%, voted in favor of the budget in New Lebanon. But because of that pesky verbiage about being above the cap, they needed to hit 60% for it to pass. Eileen Robb finds the whole thing sort of obtuse.
The fact that there is this sort of imaginary cap under which it is legal to raise the taxes and over which you need something, you know, something more is really frustrating.
Also frustrating, Blaine told me, is the fact that this debate has to happen in the first place.
It's a terrible shame that this falls on the local tax community. This should be a state issue. This, you know, our school in particular gets a little bit of a shaft because of the assessed household values in our area. Unfortunately, our town and district has a lot of second homes assessed at a very high value, which then makes the state think that we are an affluent school district, which is not the case. That really hurts us.
The New Lebanon Board of Education will meet tonight to decide whether to revise the budget. For WAMC's Hudson Catskill Bureau, I'm Sam Dingman.
It's been just over a year since Governor Kathy Hochul formally apologized to the Seneca Nation for New York State's role in operating the Thomas Indian School, a boarding school whose goal was to eradicate Native identity and culture. But now, Seneca leaders say the state has yet to follow through on promises of reconciliation. Ryan Zunner of the New York Public News Network reports.
Last May, Governor Kathy Hochul traveled to the Seneca Nation's Cattaraugus Territory to formally apologize for the Thomas Indian School, a boarding school operated by the state for more than 80 years, with the goal of forcing Native children to abandon their language, culture, and identity.
It became a place of nightmares, a place some would call a torture chamber, a site of sanctioned ethnic cleansing.
Thomas was one of hundreds of such schools operated for more than a century by various government agencies and religious institutions across the U.S. and Canada. Thousands of Native children never came home from them. Hochul pledged a commitment to reconciliation and healing.
I recommit to the truth, the justice, the reconciliation, accountability, and healing that must begin today and forward into the future.
But during a legislative advocacy day in Albany this week, Seneca Nation President J.C. Seneca said the state has yet to follow through.
She had a lot of great words, a lot of great things to say, a lot of ideas. But again, we stand here almost 1 year from then, and we haven't seen any action.
The Seneca Nation is calling on New York to fund two Seneca language immersion schools and support ground-penetrating radar studies at the former Thomas Indian School campus to search for possible unmarked graves.
If there are any of our people or other nations' remains there, then they can be identified and dealt with in a proper manner.
Seneca says if the state doesn't help pay for the search, the nation is prepared to move forward on its own. In Buffalo, Ryan Zunner for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining me now is Kevin Owens. Kevin is the CEO of NYSTEC, which stands for New York State Technology Enterprise Corporation. You can find out more at nystec.com. Kevin Owens joins us today to talk about their annual Population Health Innovation Summit. It's June 4th at the Capitol Center. It's hosted by NYSTEC, and the summit brings together over 250 leaders from government, healthcare, technology, nonprofits, and academia to share ideas that improve population health across New York State. That's a big mouthful, Kevin. And before we get into this and much more, I want to welcome you, Kevin Owens, to the Legislative Gazette.
Well, thank you, David. It's great to be with you.
Well, before we get into the conference itself, just tell our listeners what NYSTEC does. I notice your tagline says you are New York's partner in transformation. Can you explain, please?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we are a consulting firm that was created by New York and for New York 30 years ago. We'll turn 30 this fall. And we partner with New York State agencies and other governments, perhaps county governments, city governments, to really help them move through transformation projects. And it's across a myriad of technologies and solutions. And that's really why we see ourselves as New York's partner in transformation, as you said.
Yeah, so you're really, as we make transitions, as laws are passed, you're kind of there as a mitigator, right, to help that transition go more smoothly?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I often say with when we have new employees that come through, you know, government doesn't always make the right decisions,
right.
You know, but there's a lot of there's certainly new programs, new policies, new legislation, new programs that agencies or governments want to put in. And they often look to us to partner with them and help them with that transition with really, you know, a good outcome, hopefully, for our New York State citizens. You know, I always think of the work that I do is impacting, you know, not only myself, but my neighbors, my family. You know, I'm born and bred in New York, and So I really take that to heart.
Yeah, those are the stakeholders. Can you put a face on this for us? Can you give us an example of a past success and how you helped?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the more recent examples we did, we helped the Office of Mental Hygiene implement a program around Daniel's Law. So Daniel Prude was an individual who was unfortunately died with a response that came from, you know, he was having a behavioral health incident. Out of that outcome, the state wanted to implement better policies and make sure that those things don't happen again. So we worked with mental hygiene and really kind of created a task force or helped them develop a task force to kind of make sure that when incidents like this happen, the right response, the right people, the right resources are called to action. And that's, you know, that can transform individuals' lives. So we were proud to take part in that.
All right. Now let's kind of move over to the summit. This is an annual summit about population health innovation. And I understand this year's theme is going to be about social connections through reducing social isolation. I'm imagining that this certainly comes after the pandemic when so many were socially isolated. And of course, we're hearing about a lot of that through the social media that people disappear into and often end up, you know, at home by themselves with a screen.
Very much so. And I think about it, you know, in the context of my family. I have, you know, family members that are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and myself in my 50s. So I'm kind of thinking about the next phase of my life and the isolation that can be, that can surround older adults. And, you know, can they get out to visit friends? Can they see family? Can they get to a doctor's appointment? And the isolation that can entail. And then I look at some of, you know, my teenage and 20-year-old family members and think, how has social media, you know, isolated them? You know, you're sucked into your phone, and often you don't come out of it. You know, we're all victims of doom scrolling, I think, in our own way. And I think it's really important to shine a light on this and the solutions that can be shared across communities, and hopefully they're more scalable. So that you can reap the benefits, not only on an individual level, but on a community level.
You know, years and years ago now, it seems like ancient history in my life, I did a master's thesis, don't laugh, Kevin, on friendship development. But what was interesting about that research and looking at the quality of people's relationships was that the studies that I cited in what would be, you know, social scientific research came out of medical journals like JAMA, where doctors were saying those with more social ties, more quality friendships and relationships, their health outcomes are inevitably much better.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we have experts who are coming to talk about this. And, you know, we have one of our keynote speakers, Dr. Julianne Holt-Lundstad, who comes from Brigham Young University. And this is kind of her field of study. And her research is showing that, you know, lacking social connection is comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So as you're sitting home, perhaps alone or not able to interact with friends, family, neighbors, you know, how do we change that? How do we change that outlook so that you have more personal connection? And especially with COVID, I think, as you mentioned, coming out of it, people almost hibernated in self-selection. And it's really great to kind of encourage people to get back out there.
Yeah. And the idea, for example, that New York State has moved forward on banning cell phones from schools and the impact that we've seen on learning. And of course, if, again, you're in your phone, you're not interacting with your fellow classmates. So anecdotally, I've been hearing some decent results and some positive reporting, not only from teachers and administrators, but also from students.
Yeah, I think when, you know, you kind of give people the opportunity, you know, give them another option to come out of their phone, I think that you can really see results. And I think people do enjoy the personal interaction, but the phone or other social media or other technologies are so convenient. They're always in your hand. You know, they take little to no effort. But I think if you provide those opportunities where people can interact and encourage that, you're going to see the benefits and you're going to see people are thinking, you know, I want to do more of that. And I think that's important to kind of continue to encourage.
Again, we're talking with Kevin Owens, the CEO of NYSTEC, which stands for New York State Technology Enterprise Corporation. Find out more at NYSTEC.com, NYSTEC.com, that is. And this event is free and open to the public, right?
Absolutely. We certainly invite our own network of clients and associates, but really anybody, it is open to the public. And we have certainly had individuals come in years past, and we certainly hope to see some people from the public again.
I imagine that they'll have a chance to ask questions or even provide testimonials.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we will have presentations and panels and always provide an opportunity at the conclusion of those presentations for audience participation, questions, comments, etc.
One of the phrases that is sort of common
in the political lexicon, and some people don't like it and others believe it's really true, is it takes a village. And part of what you do in this conference is to bring all these folks in the village, so to speak, like industry leaders, healthcare professionals, policymakers, and researchers, so that they can kind of work together. You know, I think of it like our, you know, in our health system where we have all these experts, but they're rarely together sharing the information about the person, the whole person. This seems to be a holistic approach by doing it this way at the conference.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, people who research some of these topics, is, as you mentioned, they can be researching in isolation or with a small group of individuals and kind of sharing that information across networks. They may make another connection with someone who is doing a similar study or a complementary study. Or has a solution, and they can kind of use that expertise across across the communities in New York State to hopefully kickstart something else in their own community if something isn't happening, or help support something that's happening somewhere else as well.
And then what comes afterward? Do you write a report? Do you tell lawmakers what you're finding out? How does this all work post-conference?
Post-conference, well, I think we certainly have a number of avenues. We interact with various state agencies at all levels. So certainly some of the findings that we develop and learn from, you know, we'll be sharing with our state counterparts. And those are people who kind of have, you know, that influence in order to push things forward through their own agencies and then hopefully into the communities.
He is Kevin Owens, CEO of NYSTEC, New York State Technology Enterprise Corporation. You can find out more at nystech.com. Again, the annual Population Health Innovation Summit is on June 4th at the Capitol Center. And Kevin, I can't thank you enough for joining us to tell us about the conference.
No, thanks, David. I appreciate it. It's a great opportunity, and I hope to have a good turnout, and I'm looking forward to the day.
Thank you. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2621. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.